So part of what I have to say was originally written for a somewhat more general audience, so some of the things I'm going to whip through quickly as motivational things, which in some sense people here don't need, but then again, you never know. So the kind of things I have to say, we think have things to do with all these different kinds of systems. There's our famous friend, the Crab Nebula, and there's a whole lot of pulsar wind nebulae which have structure that's like this. Now, it used to be said by some people that the crab is unique, why are you thinking about it, but the crab is not unique. There are our favorite friends, extragalactic radio sources, and the ones I find the most interesting are the radio galaxies, which have the most well-developed jet structure. This is Cygnus A. I wouldn't go as far as say it's the Crab Nebula for extragalactic radio sources, but at least it's, you know, bright, really bright, not that far away. You can get all sorts of interesting detail about it. Gamma ray bursts, of course, you get no pictures of what's going on, but there's a strong case can be made about how the energy input is, as with here, and quite possibly with here, are things to do with pointing ducts, flux-dominated flows, and I will wedge in a little bit about this intriguing system that was discovered a year and a bit ago amongst the pulsars, or the double pulsar system. And I put down all the people whom I've either written papers with or tried to write papers with on these subjects. And all the things I have to say that are true are due to them, and all the things that I have to say that are false are due to me. And I'll leave you to figure out which is which. So a lot of my motivation comes from studying this system, where we have a huge amount of data. And my view of these matters is that having too much data is good. There are many people I know who say, well, when you have lots of data, you want to go away because it's too complicated, you'll never figure it out. My opinion is you're never going to learn anything at all unless you have more data than you can easily account for. It's all great fun to write down the first theory of whatever and maybe you'll get lucky, but if you really want to understand it, you have to know a lot. This system has this wonderful movie that was done by Jeff Hester and his friends, and by Kai Mori and his friends. Hester's responsible for HST, and Mori is responsible for Chandra, and there are many overlapping people on all these teams. What you're looking at is the guts of the Crab Nebula. There's the pulsar right there. There are these famous wisps, which were actually discovered in 1921 as moving features in the nebula, in the optical, of course. And this is about 10 months of data every 2 weeks. This is about 8 months of data sort of every month, so it's a lot coarser. And I think the thing that's clearest to me is if you look at what's going on here, we have the pulsar there at about a few tenths of a parsec, about a tenth of a parsec away there. There seems to be a sudden brightening up in this ring-like structure, which maybe is quasi-stationary with a variability going on some months-like scale. So we have never really seen this thing through a full period. There's a real question about how truly quasi-periodic it is. I'm told there's a longer campaign going on now. So this is the X-rays. And the nice feature of this is that long ago people suggested that the outflow from the Crab pulsar is some form of relativistic wind, which is behaving a la MHD. And if you ask yourself, given the known spin-down energy loss of the pulsar, and the assumption is traveling out at sea, you ask yourself for the distance where the dynamic pressure of that flow, E dot over 4 pi r squared c, is about equal to the known pressure of the nebula, which is inferred from synchrotron observations. It's right around here. You know, is it right there? Is it right there? Not very clear, but somewhere in this vicinity, there ought to be a termination. And the simplest theory you can make for this brightening up is that there's a shockwave that sits there. So this is a beautiful example where we think we have a relativistic wind with a relativistic shock terminating it, and we get to see not merely one snapshot of it, but we watch it doing something dynamic. So to me, it's a wonderful case of trying to learn something about the physics of what this energy transfer mechanism is. The galactic microquasars provide a wonderful example now. This, of course, is JRS-1915, the best studied of these things, which on several occasions has ejected plasmoids moving outwards, with apparent superluminal velocities, true velocities that are pretty strongly relativistic. And this is a miniature version of what's been known for a long time in AGN. Stop that. Now, most of what I've been thinking about is in the pulsar wind nebulae, so I'll usually use that as my case studies, but I'll once in a while bow to the other things. Here's CRAB in the X-rays, here's 3C58 in the X-rays, here's G320 also in the X-rays. And while there are huge differences in lots of the overall structure, the inner structure all shows this sort of toroidal thing here and some sort of jet or plume coming out from the pulsar. Even in 3C58, there seems evidence for this happening here. In the CRAB, we have spectral information out the wazoo. Here we have everything from radio on through egret gamma ray right there. That seems to be all synchrotron radiation. Here is the very high energy emission, and that seems to be very, very well modeled by inverse Compton radiation with the same high energy electrons that are bashing off these things. The primary soft photon source is actually the CMB, in spite of the fact there's high intensity sitting around here. But you have here a central powerhouse, a low emission transmission line, and then brightening up someplace. And this is a common state of affairs, which I at least would like to understand. This is the radio galaxies, and it's the same situation. You have it here. It does look like a line. There's a transmission line from the central galaxy out to the terminating hotspots. There are these terminating hotspots. The energy spectrum, photon spectrum in the hotspots is synchrotron radiation here. The hotspots are known to have, even in the radio, cooling times which are short compared to the transmission time from center to outside. And the best model for the X-rays that are coming from here seems to be inverse Compton rather than still more synchrotron emission. People think the jets that are going in here have Lorentz factors of a few to 10 or whatever. And the strongest evidence for that I know of is in this superluminal velocity behavior, which needs that kind of velocity. So the morphology, well, I don't know. Morphology suggests the sudden deceleration of this magnetized flow from inside to outside. And the simplest model for that is a shock wave. The gamma ray burst afterglows, the modeling suggests that you have a relativistic jet with gamma of anywhere from several hundred to 1,000. It collides with a surrounding interstellar medium. The people want to have the best, the going model for that is the the synchrotron emission in the shocked ISM and could be nonlinear as inverse Compton, which there's a version of synchrotron emission which is thought to be maybe appropriate here where the magnetic fields are very small scale, in which case Medvedev calls this jitter radiation. It's a variation of inverse Compton. Be that as it may, people want to have the shocks as they zip out into the surrounding medium do this acceleration. There's also the prompt gamma ray burst, which I'll pass over, which is less clear to me what's going on, but this is a pretty good model for what's happening. What people mean by shock acceleration in the astrophysics community is, in fact, very narrow uses of the words. Most people who are involved with modeling think of the shock acceleration they're looking for is this process, the so-called diffusive Fermi acceleration, where you have a shock in the which is infinitesimally thin in the underlying fluid. High energy particles are buzzing up and down the field lines, which for a fast magnetosonic shock refract toward the shock like this. And they are, if they're going upstream, they're turned around by scattering off of turbulence in the upstream medium, come back, pass through the shock front with not noticing the shock front because their Larmor radii are large compared to the shock thickness, go into the downstream medium. There's more turbulence back there, it scatters it back up again, so back and forth and back and forth, and you gain energy by V over C each time. A wonderful construct. And phenomenology works amazingly well. The test particle spectra that you come up from this process can be, without too much stretching, look an awful lot like what you see in both non-relativistic and the relativistic case. The relativistic case, the kinematic situation is much more forbidding for this to be the right answer, because the flow is coming in with V1 about equal to C here. A particle, if it's forced to travel along that field line, is not traveling upstream at anything like the shock velocity. It's carried along with the field line, the result of which is you actually can get back and forth in the conventional way only if the angle between the upstream flow and the upstream magnetic field is small, like less than 1 over gamma. For AGN jets with gamma equals 3 to 4, there's an unreasonable amount of phase space for this to happen. If you're looking at the pulsar wind nebulae, where we think gamma might be 10 to the 6, there's no phase space at all for this to happen. This has resulted in people suggesting that the diffusion that you need, which is primarily really in the downstream medium, is where it's really important. Because in the upstream medium, when a particle gets in here, it will be swept back right away. But in the downstream medium, you've got to turn it around and send it back up again. Downstream, you're flowing away at a third the speed of light, maybe faster if the plasma is not isotropic. It means you have to arrange the diffusion velocity to be just right. It's a little bit of tuning that's going on here. And people studying test particles going in the turbulence find that you need quite large amplitude turbulence. You don't dare let them get away very far if you're going to have this work. But nevertheless, in defense of this idea, even the relativistic case, the test particle version non-relativistically gives you an e to the minus 2 spectrum is what you would generate if you had infinite time to do it. In the relativistic case, it's e to the minus 2.3, and e to the minus 2.3 is just about what you need for what's illuminating the Crab Nebula. So that's in defense of this type of thing. Against it is it's been very difficult to find the relevant physical conditions that actually make this work.
So John, in the simulation, people state about putting the turbulence and
scattering is
The best work I know of actually measuring how much turbulence you need is test particle work done by Ostrovsky, where what he did was to create a field of magnetostatic fluctuations in the upstream and downstream fluid, and then sent test particles in to scatter off them. So instead of just saying, like people like Ellison do, saying there's hard spheres, you actually know something about what the actual magnetic turbulence level is of that sort. Okay, and it's not a bad idea. I mean, you probably expect that for such a situation where, I remind you, this interaction is based on an elastic scattering. Okay, non-resonant scattering. The fluctuating electromagnetic field of turbulence, if you want to call it that, and the high-energy particles is a non-resonant thing. And that'll come up because I'll show you some things which are, you can get an interesting effect, but depends on resonant interactions. So that's a bit about part of the motivation of looking for the shocks that's going on. Another thing is, it'll turn out quickly that we would like to take our observations of the downstream behavior of the medium and turn it into information about the upstream medium. And I'm going to be repeatedly showing things in this talk that are hijacked from my colleague Anatoly Spitkovsky. We've worked together a lot on these things, and he has many, many skills. One of them is a great artistic ability to get this stuff in a form that you can see what's going on, which I have more trouble with. Anyway, this is something he's working on, which he will talk about a lot more on Thursday. I couldn't remember, Thursday, Friday? One of these days. This is a simulation of the force-free aligned rotator, which is showing the closed dipole field lines. And then as you come out, it goes into a more or less monopolar outflow. Once you're beyond the light cylinder there, there's a Y-type neutral point here and a current sheet. So this thing, when you're far outside the light cylinder, it looks like the proverbial split monopole. All right. So you don't have any net magnetic poles. There's outflux there, inward magnetic flux here. That means there's a current sheet in the equator. And just as for the graphics, if you turn this thing around and let it rotate, you get the field lines winding up like that. Now, for the pulsar, for things like disks and jets, this is, you know, people not too sure. They would never need a truly three-dimensional rotator. For pulsars, we do think so, and this is a very nice analytic model made by Sergei Bogovalov, who took the split monopole some years ago and showed how to map it into the oblique case. Once you split the monopole, it has an axis. And so what happens is this current sheet turns into this flapping flag thing. It's bent. This is a frozen-in thing. It sits in the wind and is moving out with the wind velocity. So this is a meridional cross-section of it. this is an equatorial plane cross-section, and you get this Archimedeanly wound spiral to where the neutral sheet is. So here you have magnetic field going like that. There it's going the other way again and again. And if you sat there, it would look like an electromagnetic wave going by at almost the speed of light. In the pulsar world, people, to my amazement, think that it's all electron, or used to think it was all electron-positron pairs for reasons that are not terribly well-founded empirically. I will try to advocate that there is at least a substantial component of ions in here. This wind flow is characterized by this number, sigma, which is the ratio of magnetic energy to kinetic energy. I've done it totally relativistically here. If I took a gamma mic and it's one, minus one, you would get back to the usual. The simplest wind model has B is almost B phi, RB is constant, R squared NC, number conservation is constant. That says sigma is just some number sigma naught, this energy density ratio back at some fiducial point, usually taken to be the light cylinder, somewhere around there, divided by the Lorentz factor of the plasma. So this is bulk flow. If gamma is a constant, this sigma is, if it's big at this origin, it's big everywhere. And this has led to an endless story called the sigma problem, which showed up in the literature, actually shows up in Reese and Gunn's paper on this way back in 1974. Who did it's a very weird paper because they sort of took waves as if they were vacuum waves and dumped dense plasma in and said this is going to behave like an MHD fluid, and this doesn't compute. You can't get plasmas of high density and have the wave propagation look like vacuum. So Kendall and Carniti took this and elaborated it into a real MHD model, and they both concluded this sort of thing, that out at the termination shock here, sigma is very small, gamma is very big. The number flux into the nebula in order to explain the optical X-rays and gamma rays for the crab is a few 10 to the 38 particles per second, which is around 10,000 times the so-called Goldreich-Julian current. This is, if I put the Q back over here, it's a charge outflow rate, which is required in force-free models and high sigma MHD models of the magnetosphere of the type I showed you. That you need about a few 10 to the 34 elementary particle charges per second for the case of the crab. And its scaling is like this, where mu is the magnetic moment. An underlying problem here, which people are slowly recognizing, but nobody has figured out how to do anything about it yet, is that this number here is one that one can calculate for the theory of pair creation of these magnetospheres. The radio emission from this object, and it's true of most of the other pulsar wind nebulae too, requires an average injection rate from the pulsar, which is quite in excess of the high energy particles that go into the X-rays and gamma rays. Radio emitting particles have, in the case of the crab, have Lorentz factors of a few thousand. So they're much lower energy per particle than the characters that make this. But there's a whole lot more of them. This is unexplained. There is no theory of where this plasma comes from. And if I were ahead of things that I would like to get done, I might have something new to say about that, but I don't today. So that kind of conclusion was drawn by sort of a really crude spherical model of a Cooley aspherical system, just doing what does I need to do if I suppose there's a shock there, I accelerate, I'm going to explain the X-rays and gamma rays as if I had an unresolved object. It's all essentially adiabatic flow. Though there is synchrotron cooling for the X-rays, it's not important compared to the expansion. Leads to this interesting conclusion that the ratio of magnetic energy to kinetic energy, just as you reach the shock wave here, is very small. While back at the magnetosphere, any of these pair creation theory models, say that that sigma number should have been 10,000. And remember I said in the simplest wind models it's conserved all through the flow. So this is known as the sigma problem. It's in fact, so far as I can tell, but I freely admit I'm not, don't feel as expert about it, you run into the same sort of issues. You try to make models for jets in AGN and probably in all pointing flux driven jets and GRBs. If you think on one hand you're going to get a shock giving you the the acceleration that gives rise to synchrotron emission. This, the jump conditions for relativistic shocks tell you if you make sigma large, there is not free energy available to go into the heating of the plasma that's efficient. If I make sigma much greater than one, the conversion from pointing flux to plasma energy is like, the fraction is like 1/sigma. And so if you want to have an efficient shock model, you had better make sure that your upstream flow in one way or another is or acts as if it had low sigma upstream.
Well, all you have is magnetic dissipation and shock.
There's your friend in Israel who has this idea about a shock structure, it was high sigma upstream and low sigma downstream. That requires saying that this sector structure to the flow, that is, there's short wavelength structure in the flow, which is right up to that shock, and then what's happening in the shock is a variation of magnetic reconnection. Okay, and that's why I said it's behaving as if. Okay, there is a suggestion of that sort of thing. I won't be talking about that type of thing. It is specialized in the sense that it says the magnetic field upstream, instead of the shocks I'll be talking about, is a traditional kind of picture. On the scale of the shock structure itself, the field upstream is homogeneous. Okay, Lyubarsky's model is just the opposite. If I say the shock structure is, I got a scale of the intrinsic Larmor radii of the particles, the field upstream has a sector structure to it which is very short wavelength compared to the Larmor radii. That changes things, obviously. It's a very interesting idea. Maybe matters to these pulsar wind nebulae, although, to be blunt about it, I don't believe it. But, you know, it would take me far afield to go into that. So in the interest of trying to do something about something where we had some fairly explicit data and was originally driven by trying to model these shocks, Anatoly and I, it turned out to be part of his thesis, although I'm not sure we really meant it to be at the time. Decided to do something that was a lot more kinetic-minded. That is, you would bite out a piece of the wind structure. There's this equatorial outflow feeding this equatorial ring and torus. And we will ask ourselves, can we understand this time variability that we're seeing here based on, there we go. This thing is not liking me today in lots of ways. Can we understand this time variability based on a rather different hypothesis? I'll explain where we got this idea from later on. But we suppose that the outflow in the equator includes a stream of high energy ions, which come out with a fair fraction of the potential energy available in the magnetosphere. So supposing that the ions had a very large energy, this corresponds to a few 10 to the 15th electron volts. If you do that in the context of the Crab Nebula, you fire these ions in and they all start gyrating with very large Larmor radii. This is the gyration radius as it hits the magnetic field of the shock. They're gyrating with a fair fraction of the radius itself. So we have Larmor radii that are like a few tenths of a light year. The idea of this is that you have coming out of here an electron-positron wind with these embedded heavy ions. So the magnetic field drops like 1/r. You hit the shock in the pairs, which is thin, magnetic field jumps up, the ions come in and they encounter the shock and start going around like this. Now, these aren't test particles. If you now suppose that the ions are carrying a fair fraction of the energy of the flow, every time they do this, they will compress the medium. Okay, so I'm stopping, they're running into a wall. Doesn't matter how weak the magnetic field was in the first place, the magnetic field is like a bunch of bed springs. It'll compress up until it pushes back. What it really does is transmits that momentum to the heated pairs, which actually provide most of the pressure. So now I've got this stream of ions coming in. This is momentum for the ions. This momentum here is a function of position. And they're going through these gyrations. And if I can get the movie to work, yes. That is a nicely ion cyclotron unstable configuration. The ions go round, they rapidly turn into a gyration phase, bunching and gyration phase, and the initial part is very interesting. As you feed fresh ions in, they encounter enhanced magnetic field, which causes their Larmor radii to go down. okay, makes them bunch up into this clump that goes around, which radiates the wave, which is then keeps the cycle going. And it radiates these waves which travel outwards. These are compressional fast modes being created in the pairs. So sure enough, since the pairs get all compressed together, you get a surface brightness, which, yes, there we go, looks like that. And if I had any luck with this, well, this is supposed to remind you of what happened in the X-rays, that what you have here is a region which is quasi-stationary there, which then radiates waves which travel out, creating things going outwards with velocities that are of the order of half the speed of light. Now, so if I want to be really in advertising mode, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, talks like a duck, maybe it's a duck. There are all sorts of problems with this model, which I won't go into in detail, many of them stemming from the fact it's 1D. But it does have enough similarity to the sort of picture that it, and it has a very nice feature that the ion current that you need to get out of this is very close to this electric current that we want from the pulsar. As far as I know, this is the first thing of even interpretation of observations that's got a direct manifestation of this Goldreich-Julian current, which for anybody who's paying attention to pointing flux-driven systems is kind of the holy grail of what's part of the system. It's got to be there, or otherwise, you know, you're right.
The little flux, is that in a frame moving with
the shock? Or? I'm sorry?
Could you describe the middle plot a little more? And is that in a frame moving with the shock?
The shock is stationary in our frame on time average. So yes, the answer to your question is yes, but it so happens we're in the same frame as the nebula. All right, so the shock is a stationary shock sitting in the flow, and the fluff comes into the shock. But yeah.
Okay. The particles coming with some velocity from the left.
Mm-hmm.
And they're drifting.
Over
here. These radii continue to drift. What? I don't understand.
Well, over here I have a cold flow with E cross B drift, everybody. If I ignored all this time dependence, the electric field is constant through all here, and so I keep on E cross B drifting. But because the magnetic field has gone up, instead of having the particles being their guiding centers, now part of the momentum's got to go into gyration.
What are the axes here?
So right there is magnetic, this line is magnetic field versus position. The lower, the it is also particle momentum as a function of position. Okay?
On the right plot, it's X-ray emission?
This is a synthetic surface brightness map. That is, I say here, every time the magnetic field goes up, the pairs are frozen to the field line, so their density goes up. In the bargain, these are low-frequency waves, so the magnetic moments are conserved, so their temperature goes up. So this, the synchrotron emission goes up. It's just put particles in a flux tube and squash it, and it'll shine more. Ah, well, we modeled this in a very simple-minded way. We took the spectrum to be just a thermal, relativistic thermal distribution. Same goes if you make the spectrum of a power law. It doesn't change the physics particularly. But this calculation is not designed to do the particle acceleration, so we didn't fuss with that. I would say this kind of astronomers always, you know, they don't like it when people doing plasma physics things in astronomy go off and do plasma physics and don't say something about observations right away, which is often very annoying because, you know, it's not always possible to say things right away. There's a direct implication of this idea that as you're firing these 10 to the 15 EV ions into the nebula, they encounter a high photon density here, so you get photopion production. That includes both, then the pi zeros like to make gamma rays, and there are also pi pluses and minuses, which will make high energy neutrinos. The former is something that Ellen Amato and friends actually worked out the implications of this and makes a prediction of the UHE gamma ray flux, which is actually was within almost within the grasp of the Hegra experiment, which closed down last year. And they set a limit on, because this emission is well modeled by inverse Compton emission, they set a limit on the wind, the ions in the wind, that you couldn't have the ion, you had to have the ion 4 velocity less than 10 to the sixth, and there was a limit for a wind of this somewhat lower velocity than we were claiming, that the energy flux couldn't be more than about 20% in such a wind. It's a rather sharp-edged limit. If you went to 3.10 to the 6th, they can't say anything. So this is a very good target for the new generation of TEV telescopes, and I'm kind of hoping, of course one always likes it if one's pet ideas survive, but it would be kind of nice if we get it to the point that you can make a real collision with observations, because a lot of this stuff goes on for years without being able to say anything. And it's the Hess folks tell me that there's a good chance they'll be able to do something about this. It's difficult for them because the crab is low altitude, is a low latitude in the sky, and doing high energy showers oblique is more difficult for them, but it mainly hurts their ability to look at the lower energy photons, and here we're talking about rather high energy photons. So that's
sidetrack just a little bit. How does the neutrino flux, photon flux, compare with also could have ions observed by the polar cap? They can collide with thermal photons and these ions.
I mean, in the magnetosphere itself.
Yeah,
there are, I haven't looked at this recently. That's also a possibility. I don't remember the relative fluxes. That certainly says it'll be pulsed.
Yeah, it'll be pulsed.
Okay. And while it's not easy to do, because here you have a known period to fold your data against, so this is certainly unpulsed. So I just want to be real quick about this. Another approach to this that also leads to so the conclusion of all that was, by looking at the physics of what's going on to the termination shock, you also get to low sigma, okay? And there's one model which suggests that this structure will survive all the way out to the termination.
So and from high sigma to low sigma?
Well, I don't know. Do you? I'm sorry to answer it in a slightly combative way, but no one knows. Okay.
Wait, I thought,
so when you inject ions in a swim, so why are you getting low sigma now? I just said we infer that out of this. It's a parameter that's adjusted.
The ions are sucking up the momentum of the wind, or the energy of the wind.
They had it. They got their acceleration somewhere.
You know, the pulsar, it's high sigma.
It's high sigma. We're
so
moderate.
You cannot solve the sigma problem.
No. If I get to the point of saying I solved the sigma problem, I'll say so aloud. I just said, I had high energy ions, but this is only out of the termination shock. I said nothing about, all I know is what's just upstream from the shock, from this type of thing. Somewhere later on, if I get there, I will put down a list of possible suggestions about how this is done. And then I will have something to say about this other shock model. So another very interesting way to get at this is to actually model the global structure of the nebula, which leads to the same conclusion. And I don't want to, this is beautiful stuff. It's not my work, but the suggestion by Bogovalov and Kangulian, and it's a very similar one by Lyubarsky prior to doing simulations, which I thought was very believable. But in this modern era, if you don't do a simulation of whatever you're talking about, nobody believes you. So then some rather nice simulations were done by Sergei Komissarov and Lyubarsky, and then by Luca Delzana and his friends, doing this kind of thing, taking the flow structure no longer to be spherical, but really taking 2D into account, where the basic hypothesis is the same sort of thing that Spakovsky and I were talking about. The flow is energetically primarily in the equator. Then what comes out is there's a Mach belt, a termination shock here, and then stuff has shock that forms in an arch. There's rather high velocity flow that comes off both above and below the central thing. There's a lot of circulation in the nebula because stuff goes out and hits a wall and has got to come back. The circulation comes back, and now that we're going non-relativistically, there's magnetic hoop stress, which likes to focus down on the equator, creating the appearance of a jet. There's the simulated surface brightness map. Even though there was no jet emitted by the pulsar, which is a rather nice solution to the problem that relativistic MHD flows hate doing magnetic focusing. That is, non-relativistically, the hoop stress is a good idea to get a jet. Relativistically, the electric stresses, which you cannot omit, just about cancel that hoop stress, and you're left with not being able to make jets close to the object. This is a difficult problem. And this, I'm not sure this idea extends to any of these other systems I talked about. For this system, this type of system, it's a nice solution to this problem. Does seem to represent the basics of what's going on, not badly. So I'm fine to calling this a plume rather than a jet. It's clear that energetically there's not that much in this relative to what's coming in the equator. The way they built their model, that's required. But it's also true observationally.
What's the flow lines here?
They tend to do like you come out and then you tend to go like that. Okay. And then eventually like that.
Okay, so it is still an outflow.
There isn't that. Eventually it's outflowing. But the stuff is coming, well, it's a plume, all right? The main problem is here you're in a cavity, a box, and the box is expanding much more slowly than the outflow velocity here. So in a spherical model, everything has to come to a stop and go to velocities very much less than the sound speed everywhere. Now, because I'm in 2D, I'm allowed to circulate, okay? But nevertheless, stuff gets pretty slow as you get to the outside world because you're still in the slowly expanding cavity. I mean, you guys use an outflow velocity of a couple thousand kilometers a second at the outer boundary?
Well, it depends. Now, the latest simulations where we have a fixed velocity at the boundary, it is...
One thousand.
But in the previous simulations, we were using the expanding ejector, so they decide the velocity. It can be much higher.
Right. Whatever it is much less than C over 3.
Yeah.
0.5C comes from?
0.5C.
I mean, this velocity is measured.
You're talking about in the jet itself? Which 0.5C?
The jet itself, no?
That's the result of when they do the simulation, that the thing likes to focus in there and be going at 0.5C. It's a net result of squashing in and, you know, it's a tube of toothpaste effect in the end. You're pushing in and stuff is squeezed out. And I mean, here, because you're going non-relativistically out here, although it's fast, but it's non-relativistic, now hoop stress can work. And there's both compression due to the hoop stress and there's compression due to the stuff flowing in toward that axis. The people were fascinated with this jet. I remember when Anatoly and I were talking about his thesis, he said, I want to understand that jet. And we bet our money on the pulsar itself doing it, which didn't turn out to work at all well. But now I want to say a little bit about this sigma problem. We have on one hand from several, those flow models are tending to give, in order to get this much compression toward the axis, tending to give sigma of around a few percent. The one-dimensional stuff and our stuff on the shock structure gave something like about a half a percent. Within the level of confidence, this kind of modeling, these are the same number. It's low sigma. Okay, it's kinetically dominated. On the other hand, traditional MHD wind theory, and I think this sort of thing applies to jets too, but I have not really looked into it, says that this shouldn't happen. If I have an MHD wind, if I have this magnetization, presumably large, pointing flux-driven flow starting at the light cylinder with a ratio of magnetic energy to rest energy of the plasma, sigma naught, you should get a 4 velocity at infinity, which is like sigma naught to the 1/3, and the magnetization at infinity ought to be sigma naught to the 2/3. Okay? Big. So this is, you know, a statement in brief of the so-called sigma problem. And what are you going to do to get out of that? Well, the reason for this, I want to say a little bit about it, because I found this all very puzzling. Stuff has been around for a long time. And yet you read the paper, I would read the papers, and I couldn't understand a word of how they got to this. They do these fancy calculations, and you can follow the calculations, but where was the physics? So my understanding of the physics is about like this. The first place, people talk about these winds as being centrifugally driven, but they're not really. They're driven by the magnetic spring. You have wound up magnetic field lines. They're trying to accelerate stuff as the magnetic spring tries to unwind. Technically, the centrifugal effect is important out to the Alphane point, while the magnetic spring, that's where the field lines stop being reasonably straight and start getting bent back. But the magnetic spring can go on, in principle, go on much further because you really want to go until you actually take the magnetic energy and wound up field and store it into the kinetic energy of the plasma. And in non-relativistic winds of the type that Weber and Davis pioneered, these points are close together. The analog of the Weber and Davis problem with a rotating magnetic monopole, done first by Kurt Michael, then by Peter Gohlreich and Bill Julian, and then in an excruciatingly complicated way, but making a big step upwards in terms of our understanding by Beskin and company, is that in the monopole case, the fast point actually occurs at infinity, very far away. So it took you a long time or a long distance to actually exhaust the magnetic spring. And the question is why? So first thing you say is the magnetic spring will be working as long as you're going less than the fast mode velocity. You have to keep contact. The velocity is c times this stuff involving gamma, and it has to be less than the Alfvén speed, which is this. Very important in this racket to put the 1 back in. Don't forget about displacement current and your Alfvén waves. Then you calculate. One way you can try to convince yourself, but it's not obvious that you should do this, is to compare the 4 velocity of the plasma, okay, that's momentum, to the 4 velocity of the Alfvén waves. Okay, so construct a gamma out of this right here, and then multiply it by that velocity, measure it in units of c for the hell of it. This is gamma cubed over sigma naught, and says that I will keep accelerating until mf gets to be equal to 1. That says that gamma will reach sigma naught to the 1/3. You're done. Now, Omer's nodding. I'm sure you see what was done there. You feel convinced by that?
No.
Okay. Well, I'll try to convince you a little better, because I said, what has this got to do with anything? What is the 4 velocity of a, in a classical system, what is the 4 velocity of an Alfvén wave?
I'm still waiting for the physics you just went through.
Yeah, so I will go a little further. So, physics! In the first place, there's 2 things you want to understand. Why is gamma at infinity like sigma naught to the 1/3? And the other, the closely related thing for the monopole of the fast mode point, the ratio of the fast mode point to the Alfvén point, the light cylinder, in this case, is just sigma naught to the 1/3. This latter result, I think, is peculiar to the monopole. But the former, that gamma goes like sigma naught to the 1/3, I think is rather general. The reason I say this is that I was hoping to have this calculation done finally by the time I showed up here, but I'm not, and sure enough. But you can do various things, like suppose you had a flow tube which opened faster than a monopole. So the area going, instead of going r squared, goes like r to the 2 plus nu. Then it's fairly straightforward to show that in the case that nu is much less than 1, the ratio of the fast mode point to the Alfvén point is like 1 over nu. It goes off to infinity as you go to the monopole case. This is well known from a variety of different points of view. The monopole is a singular example. This also, in the monopole, gives rise to this. You remember I said that in the monopole case, you got fast mode was at infinity. This is the accomplishment of Beskin and company, who cranked up a Gradd-Shafranov equation in full general relativity, and then proceeds to do that in perturbation theory around the monopole for the special relativistic case, which makes the paper a bit hard to read. Nevertheless, you can understand this result along the principles I'm about to go through here. But you get this point in from infinity because there's a weak b theta. The field lines are not straight. So that's part of saying that the monopole geometry is peculiar. Now, non-relativistic, what you're used to in the fast mode point is, you know, it's energetics. That's what we're talking about. Take the magnetic energy, put it into kinetic energy. Fast mode should be equal to the fast velocity should be equal to flow velocity at the point where they're about equal. So mf squared is v squared over va squared. Not 4 velocity squared over 4 velocity Alfvén wave squared. In the relativistic case, what we know from the formal theory is that mf squared is gamma cubed over sigma, which is what looks like the kinetic energy density divided by the magnetic energy times an extra gamma squared. Now, where did that come from? So I was rather puzzled by this. Where it comes from is that if you think about what's going on here is that the waves have a certain speed, and to keep causal contact, the waves, you have to be going slower than that speed. So you're interested not in the achievement in how rapidly you can reach a certain momentum per particle, you're interested in how fast you get a certain velocity per particle. And here's a piece of stuff known to every accelerator physicist in the business, and also relativistic plasma physicists in the business. If you have an acceleration parallel to the velocity, and remember we have a poloidal outflow here, we're getting the magnetic pressure gradient minus the tension to push parallel to the velocity, then the effective mass per particle is not m gamma, it's m gamma cubed, so-called longitudinal mass. If I align accelerations parallel to the velocities, and trying to increase the velocity, already very close to c, in order to increase the velocity, it costs me a huge amount in terms of increasing the inertia. The calculation is like this, but you'll find it just replacing d by v, d by dr by d by dt. In every class of mechanics book that addresses relativistic mechanics, it says, suppose I wanted to phrase Newton's law of motion not as p dot is equal to f, but m rest mass v dot times v dot is equal to some f. Well, I'm sorry, mass times v dot is some f. What is mass? And if the force is parallel to the gamma, the velocities are all in one direction, not a synchrotron. Synchrotron, it would be m gamma, but a linear accelerator. You go to slack, everybody knows this by heart. So here's the calculation, if you like. I have acceleration, which is rho gamma cubed. There's a force on the right-hand side, which I left all the other itchy terms, just the gradient of b squared over 8 pi, which is like b squared over 4 pi r. Therefore, the velocity acceleration due to electromagnetic fields will exceed the inertia only so long as I satisfy this inequality, one greater magnetic, the fast ratio of v to some speed. It is indeed just gamma cubed divided, rest mass density as if it was, mass density as if it was rho gamma cubed. Okay, so this is my explanation of why this happens. And I think this is quite generic, although I've had a stimulating argument with Vlahakis about this, who says, oh no, you know, it really all worked out in ideal MHD. It will go really fast eventually. I don't see why, and I haven't seen anybody present a calculation you can do better than this. So that's kind of the limit of what you can get if you were doing ideal MHD acceleration in a relativistic wind. I think it's appropriate for jets too, but I haven't explicitly checked. That means that you have to open up a real can of worms. If you want to do better to get rid of magnetic energy, you're going to have to actually dissipate it. So I guess it was Amir, did you ask this? Somebody said, how am I going to dissipate it all? So there are lots of ideas. Most of the current ideas revolve around this idea that the wound-up field structure has this current sheet in it, frozen into it. And can we do something to do that? And early on, when Anatoly and I were talking about it, he did a PIC simulation of this kind of thing in 2D, and this is what the Bugwell's current sheet in the equatorial plane looks like if you rotate a dipole, and I won't go into the details of what went into what was the bottom of it all. Eject stuff, and then the fields like to compress the particles into these sheets, which go whizzing off at a bulk flow velocity. So this is just a list of ideas that are being talked about. The simplest model, this is the current sheet, and the simplest thing you can do with it is a sheet pinch. Fields are going like this in opposite directions, squashing inwards. There's pressure holding out. Everybody knows, with quotations around that, that such things like to reconnect. And so people have spent some time trying to apply reconnection to this environment with the most complete evaluation recently was by John Kirk and Olaf. Does somebody know how you pronounce his name? I forget.
Scherosen,
thank you. I've had many tries to get it straight. They think if they, you know, take the absolute maximum of the reconnection rate, it might happen at a rate fast enough if they load up the wind to the full 10 to the 40th particles per second coming out, which makes for energy conservation the flow gamma much less than we got out of this WISP model, or the MHD models of the overall structure don't say very much about the particle fluxes per se, or the original Kennel and Carnidi thing. I call this a force-free structure. There are a couple of objections to that, but as a suspicion I have is you follow these structures going out. This is where I fall off the wagon in dealing with what Liabarsky has been saying. You take this plasma flux and you try to construct the current sheet there, and long before you get to the light cylinder, light cylinder is in the crab is 10 to the ninth, sorry, the Shock is 10 to the 9th light cylinder radii away from the star. Long before you get there, these current sheets are prone to run out of enough current carriers to actually support the gradient that you have in the magnetic field going through the current sheet. And I personally think a rather interesting idea is something related to what Andrew Melatos used to be talking about, that you could convert this frozen in structure into large amplitude waves which propagate with respect to the flow instead of being frozen into the flow. That is very prone to be very dissipative indeed. But that's undemonstrated at the moment. Another idea that's been around, I think the person who's, I don't claim it for myself, I mean, I think Yuri Lyubarsky once suggested it in a conversation, although he's abandoned at the moment, is these wound up toroidal magnetic fields are in principle subject to kink instabilities, which might turn out to be dissipative. That's also undemonstrated. I would very much like to find a PWN. We were looking down the barrel of the gun. All the ones we know about, we're looking at these structures. They're tipped off. This flow is in a plane that's not pointing toward us. We get to see it from the side. I'd love to find the blazar equivalent. We were looking around the barrel of the gun. I think it's G10 has an interesting structure around the pulsar, which is sort of like a flattened bar of non-thermal emission. Maybe that sort of thing is going on, although I'm dubious. And I always wonder whether there's interesting things that could be found out from looking down the barrels of the guns in AGN and GRBs that would tell you something about this, although I've not seen anything.
What will it tell you also?
I'd like to see something direct. I'd be interested in knowing whether I had a really bright hotspot planted on the pulsar of non-thermal emission, which could be attributed to magnetic dissipation. I mean, you know, if you saw it, you might learn something.
Probably want to locate it on then.
But if I'm coming out at very high gamma, I don't, you know, I don't get to see it because I'm Doppler beamed away from it. So you only have a chance of that if gamma is quite low. Now, I have many more things to say about collisionless shocks here, and I'll be happy to do so, but I'm also hit 3 o'clock, so I'm at your service.
I guess you have another few minutes, but there will be discussion as well that people would like to have.
So, all right, I will jump ahead and show you one thing that is very annoying. This is another topic, really. I said this was a talk given for a different audience and different intent.
An audience with more patience.
No, I went a lot faster. There were fewer questions. I need to find the... There we go. So this is the results of doing 3D particle and cell simulations of the structure of a relativistic collisionless shock in electron-positron plasmas, and where, because of the equality of the mass ratios, it is possible to do 3D in a way with enough particles and enough resolution to get to see something. So what I'm showing you here is the way this kind of numerical experiment was done is you start off with plasma filling a box, and down here there's a wall at the end which bounces the particles off. So if the particles bounce off, they start going back upstream and they start interacting with stuff coming in ahead. This case is one where the magnetic field is transverse to the flow. Okay, so sure enough, as particles come in, they hit that magnetic field, and they start gyrating. And you saw this before in our model of the ions. There we had the ions sitting in an MHD model of the pair, so they had Larmor radii disappeared. Now everybody's on an equal footing. And so you have in the momentum in the flow direction here as a function of position, every dot represents a particle of which there are, what, 500 million particles total? So what's plotted here is a long way from the total number of particles available. The ZX direction, if you're coming in, if Hank is the target, the magnetic field is that way, and the electric field is that way, okay, V cross B. So here is the electric field direction up like this, and you get to see here that the particles go back and forth as they first come. It's the big current there that's giving the jump in the magnetic field. Here in the other direction, the direction parallel to B, things look somewhat similar to what happened here. Particles go around in this clumping up in the gyration in the phase density. The annoying thing, or very interesting thing, if you just put aside your prejudice about what you knew you had to find, and ask what is this version of nature trying to tell you, here's what it tries to tell you. There is the particle distribution function. It is a wonderful Maxwellian up to the point that you lose particle resolution. This is like 6 kT. So if you wish to believe that somewhere in here there's enough turbulence to give scattering back and forth, for the highest energy particles, yes, but you would say you're already inefficient, like e to the minus 6, which is a very unpleasant answer from the point of view of applications. The origin of this effect is that for this kind of shock, there is a wave spectrum that's produced. The wave spectrum, I don't have a plot of it here. The waves that are produced here is, once again, you have particles sort of quasi-coherently gyrating in the shock front. They radiate a lot of waves. What are the waves that are available? For this situation, they're so-called upper hybrid waves. They're above the effective value of the plasma frequency. There is a lot of reabsorption of these waves. So it's a resonant emission and a resonant reabsorption. And you just think about what you were told way back before we got involved in all this complicated physics. If I had rapid emission absorption, I thermalize. So I thermalize to a relativistic temperature. There's nothing original about that. The level of turbulence is much too small to do anything effective in terms of scattering. For this case, it's the cyclotron instabilities here. We've also looked at sigma equals zero. This has become famous in the GRB crowd, who pointed out that you could get an interesting effect by having two interpenetrating plasmas. They're not magnetically insulated from each other any longer. But you get a Weibull instability occurring. This is forming of current filaments in an otherwise B naught equals zero plasma. Indeed, this happens. And the structure is much more extended. Here again is momentum space, is much more extended. There's a rather slower relaxation, but the end result is the same. I didn't write it down here. I had another slide where I had this down, but you can easily estimate based on magnetic trapping ideas that delta B squared over NKT in this region down here, where you want to get that diffusion, is like 10 to the minus 2. It's quite typical of Weibull instabilities. From Ostrovsky's simulations, you know, Monte Carlo's, that is way too small to do anything effective in relativistic Fermi acceleration. This is the most favorable case. I've got no magnetic field preventing me from going upstream. It will do whatever it do its best. It's not doing it.
The structures on which delta B is actually in here are quite small.
C over omega P,
and then you don't.
If you got Anatoly to give you one of his many talks, he would show you his attempts to find out from these simulations how much residual B field there is. The last time.
Well, it grows to larger scale.
Yes.
Eventually fills the whole box. But
it's very, very weak.
Very low level. Yeah. Right.
And my opinion of watching what's happened to these simulations is that question really. The level of turbulence amplitude is sufficiently small that it's probably more effective to think about some form of mode coupling theory, because it's kind of hard for the simulations to keep track of what's happening at the very small amplitudes that are going on here. Not impossible, but it's a lot of work, and you're at a level where theory of merging of current filaments is something that one could make some progress with.
But I was thinking more about the scattering issue, whether you could actually reflect up these magnetic structures. If they become so small scale that once the Lama radius is,
well, you can still do it. I mean, if you're high sigma, you will be prone in weak field. You're prone to get that the Lama radius, the scale size of things as they start are like C over omega P. That's a smaller scale than the Lama radius. So particles will instead go through here and scatter. It's like Coulomb scattering. They scatter off a bunch of random fluctuations in the field, and you get a very diffusive structure. Eventually, you'll scatter. but you have both, you know, is there enough to get back? What's the time, if you could even, what's the time scale to really develop the spectrum? Because that depends on that diffusion time. It's going to lengthen very long time. So I'm a bit pessimistic that if you treat this business of looking for Fermi acceleration and relativistic shocks, at least as far as the E plus minuses are concerned, I don't see any evidence that it's going to work. Now, I will conclude then with some old things and some new things. That is, if you do this with electrons, positrons, and protons, this is from an old simulation that's, well, must be getting close to 14 years old, done in 1D, you get rapid heating of E plus minus, and then the ions go through this gyration thing and get heated up. But there is some evidence in this, because the wave spectrum, for reasons I don't have a clear physical reason for this, but the wave spectrum that develops, you're looking at ion cyclotron waves and their harmonics, and you get this parallel-like distribution. Okay, you put a pair into that, it likes to absorb the highest harmonics where it's resonant and gains energy, and then it moves to a lower harmonic, a lower one, and you do get parallel distributions out of this type of thing. That's all done in one dimension. And Elena Amato and her thesis did a bunch of things which we claim this time we're going to get written up. You can see here, for various ratios of the ion to electron fraction, you can, as you raise the amount of energy, total energy in the ions, you get more and more energy put into parallel tail here. From her simulations, these are the parameters, and I find the where was the spectral index? There. Okay, in here are spectral indices of number of particles in between E and E plus DE. So it's the usual thing that a synchrotron modeler wants to look for. And it ranges when the ion density is small to very steep, and the ion density is large, you get better. But there's different in electrons and positrons here, which occurs for a technical reason that I'll be happy to explain to anybody who wants to know, but that's has to do with what it takes to keep charge and
relative. What's the difference between the last two?
There?
No, one is 0.1 and the other one is 0.2. There.
I'm sorry, that's right, I made a mistake. This is, I wrote that wrong. These are still increasing Ni to Ne. It's these numbers. This should be 0.1 and this should be 0.2. Okay, sorry about that.
But physically, this is because you're signing up.
I don't know why it's a power law of the slope that it has. It looks like, it tends to look like in 1D stuff, it tends to look like k times b sub k squared is a number like k to the minus 1. Okay. The way the mechanism of energy transfer is going is this resonant absorption.
But
I don't have a.
But that's what sets up the power law.
Yeah, I don't have a clear physical model for why the wave spectrum is a power law, and I'm rather eager to see what it looks like in 3D, because we've learned various lessons from the 3D about the pair case, which can change things a lot.
So what is the slope again?
The power law slope? Yeah. Down here.
So.
You can get whatever you want by adjusting the ion content.
Uh-huh. It doesn't really explain this, let's say, GRB afterglow spectrum.
I don't remind you what the GRB afterglow.
2.3, if you mentioned. I mean, you can.
I can go in there.
Natural way to produce.
Well, it depends what you mean by natural. I mean, you know, the great advantage of the diffusive Fermi is in the test particle model. You got this answer independent of all of this microscopic physics. That makes the astronomers overwhelmingly happy, because they can go to sleep and not think about the microscopic physics. Okay? If you had a universal answer to non-thermal spectra, which we don't, all we have is slopes that are like energy of the minus, around energy minus 2, then you'd need a universal answer, if this were the right model for it, for why the ion content is always that way. Which I certainly can't. I can tell you some ideas about how to do that in the pulsars. That say that, you know, where we had the ions coming in with a large fraction of the energy, which is how we got onto that whole subject, in order to make the shock, we encountered this business that the relativistic shock in E plus minus plasmas do thermal spectra in 1D simulations years and years ago, Everybody, you know, I got answers from all sorts of people saying, oh, when you do it in 3D, you'll see diffusion, and it'll be all okay. Well, sorry, guys. With ions, it's not, the situation's not at all clear. You know, this is one way you can get parallel-like output by having a resonant reaction. Remind you, this is all 1D stuff. So diffusion across field lines is forbidden in that context. Now, with maybe with heavy ions there, there will be an interesting amount of turbulence. I don't know. There are a couple of things in the back room that have ions in them with 3D with mass ratio of 16. This is, you know, maybe will tell us something. Well, I could say lots more, but that's enough.
Thank you very much.
I didn't get to talk about the double pulsar, which is a lot of fun, but is a little bit off the mark.
We'll have talks about that sometime. Discussion, please.
Steve, you didn't ask me the questions you said you were going to ask.
So you guys are working on 3D versions of those big simulations you're showing?
They are 3D. Well, some of them are 3D.
V plus minus was 3D.
No, the V plus, right, but the ones with ions.
So I have the 3D with ions, and it shows...
Oh, so you guys already know the answer.
A little bit.
Well, it's not as exciting. There is something that looks like either a parallel tail or two temperature distribution. So it looks like a one part Maxwell and then another part Maxwell. So ions seem to have some sort of acceleration, but it's not Fermi. If you look at where particles are accelerated, it's not because they're crossing back and forth. They're accelerated in current sheets in the filaments of the.
This was with the cyclotron thing, or was it the Weibull?
This is a more Weibull.
This is Weibull, right? And the ions are accelerated in the filaments of the Weibull. Are you saying? Well, the electrons are accelerated in the filaments of the Weibull.
Right.
Yeah. For the case of the electron positron ion magnetized, there is also something that looks like an unthermal tail, but it's for the mass ratio that I had, which is only 16, and that comes again from these turning points. It's not a Fermi process.
You should be. There have been a number of papers published recently, especially focusing on the Weibull type thing by Aki Nordland and his group, and Nishikawa and his crew. And they're saying, we see acceleration. And what there's, the Nordland company is seeing the same thing Anatoly was just talking about. That there's, and the real thing you should be careful about with that is that anything but the most blinding optimist, what they're looking at is the initial phases of thermalization. You know, they present very short segments of the spectrum and say, there's a power law. We could just as well fit it as part of a Maxwellian that is incompletely resolved. That in the Danish group stuff, you see these ions boring their way. They've made current channels, and they're buzzing their way along with hardly even begun slowing down. So right in the front edge of this shock structure, then they're seeing some electron heating, which may or may not be non-thermal for a while. But if what your goal was to model gamma ray bursts, which is where they got their motivation from, you need to actually make that non-thermal distribution be through most of the shocked volume if you're going to get the energetics at all right. And there's not even close to being able to say anything like that.
In some frame, you've got a cloud of electrons and ions and another cloud of electrons and ions colliding.
Right.
In reality, they work in the left frame, which means that they have one cloud and another slams into it. What we do, we have one cloud that slams into the wall and sends a shock back. This way, you're kind of imagining two clouds colliding with you
right.
In the mirror. Don't seem like that when you're doing it. So you don't want to make your shot stationary in your simulation?
It would be nice.
It's hard because then you need to take care of the outflow, right? If you have a stationary shot, you have to flow through it, and then you have to take it away out of your domain.
time in subsonic outflow.
This is an example of what done by the UCLA group. This was colliding electron positron plasmas.
But this is a periodic domain.
But with a periodic domain. Okay. So there are many issues here about whether, you know, because things like to coalesce.
Stuff is going on. Along
the VX. Yeah, stuff likes to coalesce till it fills your periodic domain. You're sort of left, well, then the next domain over is influencing what you're seeing. And so it's, you know, doing. So. You know, I'll put my conclusions up so that if there's a lot that we don't know about this, but I have to say, you know, it's one of these, well, in a way it's a little bit about reconnection. People have known for many years that saying a reconnection velocity is a 10th VA is a very successful phenomenological velocity model for certain kinds of simple things. Finding the reasons why this should be true in a way that you can actually control it has been, it's not clear it is like that always, but there are possibilities itself. This very beautiful stuff with the shock structure, with shock acceleration is a wonderful model, but if it has a basis in, at least in the relativistic case, a basis in the underlying physics, there hasn't been any real signs of that yet. And I'm not sure which direction to go on it. It can be, you know, as the stuff that we've found, that you can get acceleration based on these resonant processes, and maybe that's the answer, but it's not, you know, it doesn't have quite the one-liner that goes into the diffusive Fermi to
well,
it.
I'm not giving up on the idea for Fermi acceleration for unmagnetized shock. I think it's still possible.
Right.
So our dynamic range in terms of size of the simulation is very tiny compared to astrophysical scales. So in principle, I tried sending a test particle through my shock, replicating my shock structure many times. And you do get scattering eventually, but it takes like a thousand of my boxes. So maybe there is diffusive Fermi, but on a much larger scale. It will affect the rate of acceleration, of course.
The issue there, of course, is the same as the old Lagage and Cesarsky one for non-relativistic shocks. That is, phenomenologically, you have to develop a power law distribution of particles on a very on a fairly wide range of particle energies. This takes time, and that's controlled by the diffusion time. If you make your diffusion coefficients very, mean free paths very long, it takes you a very long time, and you don't get to high energy. If you do that just for cosmic rays, and you make the assumption that the scattering, no matter what energy you add, the scattering is at the Bohm rate, you just marginally can push a supernova remnant up to the point that it will get to 10 to the 14 or so EV. Makes the cosmic ray physicists would love to have the old model of the interstellar medium, and most of it was very low density, high temperature medium, so the supernova remnants can become very big and last a very long time. Nobody works in the interstellar medium thinks that's acceptable. Lots of evidence is not so. What's the answer? I don't know. If you try to do the scattering turbulence in that case self-consistently, that the cosmic rays made their own, you run out of steam at 10 to the 12th EV. So you have to put in scattering from someplace else. So it's the same position. Never mind if you wanted to get cosmic rays up to 10 to the 17 or 10 to the 18 EV, which is where the upper limit of what's thought to be galactic particles. Here we have the same issue. And I have a toy estimate doing just this as a function of delta B over B squared in the downstream of these relativistic shocks of how long it takes. I quite agree with Ostrovsky's numbers. You're not going to get anywhere unless you have his kind of turbulent amplitude, which is delta B over B is of order unity. None of these PIC simulations are showing anything like that.
I think they need more than unity.
Yeah, some of his examples had it really, really large.
Really more than unity. Right. I mean, I get on a good day. Mm-hmm. But they need much more than that.
Right.
There's also this problem in afternoon that you need to amplify the field. That's the claim. So I thought that was part of the motivation of the wide
instability. Oh, yeah, the idea that Medvedev and Loeb originally had was that they could make magnetic fluctuations and then maybe they'd merge into something that was enough of a persistent field that you could explain why you got B squared in those models far above which ordinary shock compression gives.
Not only does it magnify the field, it makes the field. You can start with zero field.
Is it consistent with what you need from the observations?
Well, the question is,
10% coefficient.
Well, so during the peak, a magnetic field can easily reach 10% of a coefficient. The problem is how long that peak lasts. the field very quickly starts reconnecting and disappears, basically. So it drops. So if you look at the field energy as it goes through the shock, it peaks and then it decays very fast on this scale of tens of C over omega P. And it decays what looks like to a percent of equipartition. And then I kind of lose resolution. So I cannot tell you whether it stays at 1% or continues to decay.
So here's an example of a Weibull type thing where the red line, this is hard to see, somebody wants to kill the light. There's a red line here.
There is?
Yes. Anybody who's not colorblind, tell me when I'm pointing at the red line, but it's down here somewhere. You know, and it comes up and then sort of dies away. This is what I was saying, that it's very difficult from these calculations to tell what's happening in the long time limit, because you're left with things that, you know, the methodology is not the greatest for looking at these relatively small effects.
So when the magnetic energy is 10%-ish, but then the field is in very small scales, right?
Yes.
It's hard to do anything with it.
Depends what you want to do.
If
it's good at scattering particles, that's what makes
it strong. If our energy particle is coming through a small scale field, it won't get deflected much before it's bent back the other direction.
Yeah, so you get
you get some diffusive kind of thing.
It's a Coulomb shock, except you did it with little magnetic lumps instead of electrostatic lumps.
I know, but the smaller the scale, you have to get a lot further, right?
That's what goes into saying that the mean free path in Coulomb scattering is log lambda times this silly little estimate. You have to accumulate stuff until you get the full 90 degree scatter. You can do it; it just makes a diffusive structure, which is right there. That's a relatively diffusive structure. This is many C over omega P's going through here.
Shall we wrap up and continue the discussion more about it?
Thank you.